Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist and professor, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, hoping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, what does the future of psychiatry look like? Spoiler alert, it's not conversations or medications per se. And later, did HBO's monster zombie hit, The Last of Us, partially predict our fate? Author Emily Mnason argues that the seeds of a fungal pandemic are already here. But first, do you remember this song? I know I do. It's literally one of the songs that served as the soundtrack to my high school years. I loved it then and still do. Boston's iconic track talks about a person who is searching for something more than what they currently have in their life. They're looking for a feeling, a mind space, that they can't quite put into words. In many ways, it reminds me of our current mental health crisis, where so many people are looking for an elusive and increasingly ephemeral emotional equilibrium. For those suffering with mental health issues, especially those who've tried talking through them or taking medications without any benefit, more than a feeling takes on a new meaning. Yet technology is providing us hope. Today we'll explore a realm where mind meets medicine, where psychology intersects with precision, and where innovation reshapes our understanding of mental well-being. I'm talking about the world of interventional psychiatry, a cutting-edge field that bridges the gap between traditional therapy and groundbreaking medical interventions. It's where brain scans can reveal the root of an individual's emotional struggles, and where a delicate touch with modern technology can reset the mind's equilibrium. So stick with us as we unravel how magnetic pulses, deep brain stimulation, and psychedelic therapies are revolutionizing the treatment of depression, anxiety, and other mental health conditions. These treatments are dramatic and may lead to transformation for individuals once trapped in the depths of despair, helping them find newfound hope and vitality. Joining us now is Dr. Heather Lewing. She's a psychiatrist who spent her career in leadership roles as a medical director and chief medical officer, or CMO. She's a triple board certified psychiatrist with expertise in forensic psychiatry, addiction medicine, and adult psychiatry. Neuromodulation is a special interest, and she's currently medical director at the Florida Center for Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation, also known as TMS. Dr. Lewing joins us in studio. It is so good to have you here.
Thank you. It's exciting to be here.
Well, we're going to get right into this. I know I described in the intro a bit about interventional psychiatry, but can you explain to listeners what is interventional psychiatry and how is it different from traditional therapy?
So this is a new area of psychiatry, and even though some of the procedures that we do in interventional psychiatry are not particularly new, it being considered a subspecialty is really an emerging part of the field. So I like to tell people the things I do at Florida Center for TMS are the kind of things your psychiatrist probably doesn't do in their office. So I offer some alternative procedures that are all FDA approved, meaning that they've gone through that testing to show that they have efficacy, they work, but they also have safety that the FDA looks at through testing. And things like transcranial magnetic stimulation, vagus nerve stimulation, and esketamine, which is a nasal spray, but also a procedural-based part of psychiatry.
This is pretty exciting because I know how different it is from what most people see in their heads when they hear the word psychiatry. What kinds of conditions does this emerging field, interventional psychiatry, treat in psychiatry?
So it's definitely something where we're getting new indications, but traditionally mood disorders have been a big part of it. So depression, particularly depression that doesn't respond well to medication treatment, what we call OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder, that's another area that's often treated. And really the newest FDA approved indication for transcranial magnetic stimulation is tobacco cessation. So we're getting more and more ways that we can apply these technologies to different problems that people struggle with.
Given that this is coming online and several of these techniques, although approved, as you said, it's a burgeoning area, at what point do you say, you know, we have done a psychotherapy, we have tried the traditional medications, what point do these type of treatments come into the equation during the life cycle of some condition?
You know, I think, again, that's a very individualized thing. We try to treat people really as individuals, but I would say a lot sooner than you might think. So, for example, the American Psychiatric Society Association recommends that TMS is actually second-line treatment, meaning that you failed one antidepressant, TMS is an approachable next step for you. There's definitely realities in medical practice that make that maybe not so easy to always obtain. There's insurance coverage and some aspects we may talk about, but I think it's a lot earlier than you think. And when I talk about depression treatment, what I've really learned over time is that treating depression is really an emergency. The longer people go with untreated depression, the harder it is to treat. And if they do respond, the more likely they are to relapse. And so I would say if you're not getting response from more conventional treatments, looking at interventional psychiatry is a good next step.
As best as you can, and this is kind of one of those questions that may have a complicated answer, how does a technique like, well, what is transcranial magnetic stimulation and how does it work?
So transcranial magnetic stimulation uses a small magnet. It's similar to what's in an MRI machine, but a lot smaller. And what we do is we apply magnetic pulses to an area of the brain that we know in depression is hypoactive, meaning it's kind of gone to sleep on the job. It's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. And that's an area in the prefrontal cortex. So we stimulate that with magnetic pulses, which is non-invasive. It's not painful. It's not something you need anesthesia for. And what it does is it helps those neural circuits to kind of wake up and reconnect and start talking to other areas of the brain and ultimately help your brain act normally.
One of the things that I often get as a question to me from others, and I'm not a psychiatrist, is what role will talk therapy? Is that something that's dying or is that going to be complementary? Because everyone always talks about go into therapy, discuss issues. Where does talk therapy fit into the general realm of things?
So I always talk to patients about the fact we know from the research the best way to treat mood disorders is combining a biological treatment, so something like an intervention that we're talking about today, or traditionally a medication, with a psychological treatment, which is something like talk therapy. Depends on the individual. So if you've gone through a lot of trauma, you've had issues in your life where you need to really work on your thinking or your coping skills, and therapy is an essential part. But for some people who develop mood disorders, that just comes out of the blue and they don't have a history of trauma. They may find that in therapy, they don't even have a lot to talk about. But I think for most people, there's at least something that they can benefit from dealing with in therapy. So we usually recommend a combination of those two interventions to really get the best results for patients.
As you look over the past couple of years, because we now, the good news is we're talking mental health. There's the 988 emergency line now. It's on everyone's mind about how we are in this whole throes of a mental health crisis, if you will. What promising breakthroughs have you seen in this area, interventional psychiatry, over the past few years that could make a difference?
You know, I think it's interesting when we talk about mental health, because even though it's getting more attention, I think we're still dealing with some stigma. Okay. And that's a problem. That's something we have to keep working at, because just like any other medical condition, mental health really isn't any different. It's a problem with the brain, which is one of the organs in the body. I think that we've had some exciting things come along in interventional psychiatry, even going back about 15 years when TMS was first approved. Most people still don't know about it.
So it's been around for 15 years and it still gets kind of attention.
FDA approved for that long, yes. And most people still don't know about it. Even some psychiatrists don't know about it. So spreading the word, I think, is important. Certainly, though, this is an exciting time in psychiatry because we're having a lot of advances. I think one of the most exciting things that happened recently is about 3 years ago when esketamine or Spravato was FDA approved. And what that is esketamine is a nasal spray. It's an antidepressant. You use it alongside actually an oral antidepressant as what we call an augmenting agent, or something to help an antidepressant work better. But the exciting thing is it works on a completely different neurotransmitter in the brain. So it works on the glutamate system. And glutamate is exciting because when we see people have a response to glutamate, it's fast. Sometimes as early as 24 hours, often within the first week. So instead of waiting months for a traditional oral antidepressant to take effect, something that works on serotonin or norepinephrine, we found a much more direct way to treat depression from a neurotransmitter standpoint using glutamate. So I think that's super exciting, and I see the results on a day-to-day basis with my patients. But, you know, probably what gets the most attention these days is the psychedelics. And
sure,
those are on the horizon, not quite here yet, at least not in an FDA-approved way, but certainly something patients are talking about and interested in.
Let me bring up something you said a moment ago. So here we have the transcranial magnetic stimulation approved almost 15 years ago, still gets attention, as you said, some people don't even know it. And I guess my question to that is, why is that? Why is, like, in some areas, like I smell, like Ozempic comes out and my goodness, they cannot keep that on the shelves. But then you have a treatment that's not even a medication that could be hugely helpful for a condition that is everywhere and people still don't know about it. Is that the stigma, or is there something else going on, do you think?
I think part of it is the stigma. So let's say you come into the clinic and you have a great response. You may not be comfortable going and sharing that with your neighbor. So I think there's a limited amount that kind of word of mouth spreads. It's also been complicated by the fact that, you know, I think we have a mindset with depression that I'll just take a pill and it's going to get better. And we've kind of broken down our understanding of how depression works over time into such an oversimplistic way. Sometimes patients will even come in and just tell me, well, I think I have a serotonin deficiency. We know that's not true. And we actually know now, you know, the way we thought about depression conceptually probably isn't even accurate. But I think that's become kind of part of our culture where brain stimulation sounds scary. It sounds like ECT or electroconvulsive therapy.
Yes.
So I spend a lot of time talking to patients about how these two are radically different, both great treatments, but very, very different.
that I imagine, like television shows, I'm thinking of things like Homeland and certain movies, when they show these things, they're not shown in maybe as realistic a light as possible.
Absolutely.
Are there any ethical considerations or risks associated with using these interventions for mental health conditions?
I think it depends on the intervention, what the risks are. So we always talk to patients about the risks, the benefits, the side effects, and the alternatives to any kind of treatment. Certain treatments, like we were talking about ECT or electroconvulsive therapy a minute ago, those treatments have significant side effect burden. You're having anesthesia. You know, those are things that do have some risks. On the other hand, you know, we have newer treatments like transcranial magnetic stimulation that are actually very safe, a lot of times less side effects than medications have. So I think it really depends on kind of what you're talking about specifically. You know, I think when we get into talking about the psychedelics and even esketamine, those have some potential risks that I want to talk to patients about and I want to screen patients for, because it's not the kind of thing that it's going to be for everyone in those situations.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about what the future of psychiatry looks like, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. Let me ask a question that's in the reverse. Are there some folks or people that they shouldn't go down this route of some of the interventional options?
I think it's a pretty small group. For every type of procedure, there's of course going to be contraindications. For example, with TMS, if you have a history of a seizure disorder, that's a contraindication. So there's always going to be those kinds of things. Most of these therapies are approved for people 18 and up. So a lot of times for children, if they're interested in this, it's going to be an off-label or experimental thing. And that's complicated, I think, for parents to, first of all, determine what the risks and safety are, but also from a practical standpoint about insurance coverage. But for people 18 and up, I would say most people this is going to be an option for. And if it's something that you're interested in, talk to your doctor, you know, get on Google, learn a little bit more about whatever the intervention is. And for most people, it's probably an option.
You know, in my field, in the world of neurology and areas like that, imaging, MRI, CTs play a huge role. How have advancements in that area changed or contribute to how we manage mental health conditions?
It's been pretty slow. We don't have a lot of imaging that gives us really practical clinical implications. But I think we're moving that direction. So, for example, again, with transcranial magnetic stimulation, it's not recommended at this point to use neuroimaging. It hasn't shown in the research to be superior to other ways we have of finding the correct area to stimulate. However, there's a whole new protocol that was recently studied at Stanford, and that SAINT protocol does involve neuronavigation using functional MRI. So I think that's in the future. We're just not quite there yet. But in the next few years, I would expect to see some changes in the field.
That would be something incredible. Wow. Without giving away any privacy, are there any success stories that you could share of people whose lives have been transformed by some of these interventional psychiatric treatments?
Absolutely. That is the best part of my job, is that I literally get to see these success stories every day. And what I've become passionate about is not having people live with suboptimally treated symptoms. You know, I think as a field, for many years, we didn't have the most efficacious treatments. Our treatments just didn't work for everybody. And so we've kind of learned to deal with just, oh, you're a little bit better. You know, that's good enough. What I've learned is when these patients come in and they've felt that way for decades, we can get them where they feel a lot better, or they feel totally normal and the depression's in complete remission. So I get to see these people all the time. And a lot of times I'll meet people for the first time on the inpatient unit, where I also work as a psychiatrist, and they'll come in actively suicidal, really at their lowest point, their worst day of their life. And I get a chance to get them through this entire treatment system, you know, transitioning from inpatient to outpatient, getting interventional treatments and getting them back to being the person that they used to be and being able to function and just enjoy their lives.
What a huge, I mean, that's huge, just hearing that potential hope and promise. One other area that's become so, so important is mindfulness techniques, lifestyle changes, complementary therapy. How do you integrate some of these holistic approaches, mindfulness, lifestyle changes, meditation, things of that sort, into the larger scope of management with the interventional psychiatric techniques as well as the others?
I think it has a role with every single patient. So I am always talking about these interventions. I believe we treat the entire person holistically. Exercise is a huge one. We see great improvements with mood, with exercise on a regular basis. Good nutrition. There's certain things you can eat that really help your brain health. And certainly mindfulness and meditation. I even talk to patients about something as simple as using an app for that as a way to start learning and getting comfortable with that concept. And I find that it really helps patients, and it also helps these interventions last longer and be more effective.
Let me ask you about a very specific intervention. You brought this up already because of the ketamine, yes, ketamine, that you mentioned. Who is that directed towards? What are the circumstances? Because as you know, there are a lot of ketamine clinics, and there's a lot of buzz around that particular agent. Can you go over, like, who is the right folks for that type of treatment you're talking about in interventional psychiatry?
Absolutely. And ketamine or esketamine, these are kind of the first, they're not quite psychedelics, but they're kind of in that family, and you get a little psychedelic flavor from them. What I would encourage is, it's a little bit like the Wild West out there.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to get more so that way before it gets better. So working with a physician that you trust, you know, following FDA approved guidelines, those are the things that help keep people safe and hopefully prevent us in psychiatry from getting into a situation like we saw in the pain field a few years ago. You know, we want to make sure these interventions are used with the right patient population, they're used in safe ways, and patients are monitored appropriately. So with esketamine, it is a treatment-resistant depression or a severe depression with suicidal ideations. Those are the two groups of patients that would be appropriate for esketamine.
Let me ask you about another agent. It does not fall under interventional psychiatry, but it seems to be everywhere, and that is CBD, THC, cannabis. Where do they fit in the realm of psychiatric treatment as it pertains to interventional psychiatry?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I don't think we really know where they fit. And that's because, you know, they kind of came into the medical field in a very different way through the legislative process.
That's right.
So we don't have the studies behind them to really know. I can tell you, you know, the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, does not recommend them for any type of psychiatric treatment. We personally haven't seen the research that shows us there's a place for that in the field. You know, working in an inpatient unit as well, I often see kind of the negative side of that, where people develop psychosis and have side effects. Wow. And so it also can really interact with medications working. For example, esketamine and ketamine do not work well with cannabis combined with them. It can both decrease how well they work as far as efficacy and increase side effects.
Wow. What do you see as how would you characterize or describe the current state of research on the long-term effects of some of these techniques that are within interventional psychiatry?
Yeah, I mean, I think we learn more every day. This is a rapidly evolving field, so there's a lot of research. You have to stay up to date with things. You know, the nice thing about some of our interventions is that they've been around a long time now. Others are newer, but we do have some good long-term data. For example, there's now a new 4-year open label safety study for esketamine. So things like that are helpful for us to see not only anecdotally how our patients do, but also in a longer term open label study. But we have to follow it over time because we could still learn new things.
How do you see the future of mental health treatment evolving? Given, we see this field, we're having this conversation now. In a few years, it may be even slightly more different. How do you see the field of when a patient sees a provider in mental health space evolving as a result of all this?
You know, it's hard to tell. I couldn't have told you 2 years ago that all this telehealth would now exist and that right. most of the time you're seeing your psychiatrist or your psychiatric provider on your phone screen, right? But what I can tell you and what I tell patients is that it's a time of great hope. There are so many wonderful new treatments that are being approved that work so much better than what we've seen previously. And so I think whether you're dealing with depression or schizophrenia, really any type of mental health problem, there are new and exciting treatments coming, and I think we're going to find they help a lot more people.
What about affordability and accessibility? Is that, we can develop all this, but if you can't see someone, you're not going to get it. How do you see that evolving as a result of all of this?
Yeah, so anytime a new intervention comes out, it takes time to get insurance coverage. At this point, we have excellent insurance coverage for transcranial magnetic stimulation. We have excellent coverage for esketamine. Vagus nerve stimulator is actually in a big trial right now called the RECOVER trial that we're part of at our clinic. That's the whole point of the trial is try to get Medicare coverage for it so that more people are able to access that as a treatment. But as these new treatments come out, these are question marks. You know, with the psychedelics in particular, they're being studied as not just a medication, but an 8-hour day that includes two therapists working with a patient. And that's going to be an expensive intervention. Wow. Wow. So I think we have some questions about how that's going to be covered. And hopefully in the next year or so, as that's FDA approved, we're going to get some answers.
Now, briefly, in our last moments that we have with you, someone out there may be struggling with a mental health problem, perhaps depression, maybe severe anxiety or other areas. How can people learn more about the treatments that you're discussing, and what point would you like to make sure that they take away from having listened to our conversation today?
You know, I think you have to do a lot of research these days. You know, you may go talk to your doctor and they may not know about some of these newer treatments that are available. So start there. Start by talking to your doctor. But if you're not getting the answers that you feel like are helpful, you know, do some research. Look at what's FDA approved. I think that's a very good way to start because you can have that peace of mind that these things have been studied and that there is a level of knowledge about what to anticipate as far as side effects and adverse events, as well as what percentage of patients get better from certain treatments.
Dr. Lewing, I want to thank you so very much for really, this has been very enlightening for me. I really appreciate all your work you do and the stuff that you do to help so many folks. Thanks so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We've been talking to Dr. Heather Lewing. She's a practicing psychiatrist and medical director at the Florida Center for TMS, or transcranial magnetic stimulation. And up next, did HBO's Last of Us presage our future? Our next guest argues that perhaps it has. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It? You know, HBO's hit show, The Last of Us, paints a world in which fungus have turned humans into zombies. Our next guest is here to sound an alarm. Emily Monison is an adjunct faculty member at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and her fantastic new book literally kept me up at night and is called Blight: Fungi and the Coming Pandemic. She joins us now from her home in Massachusetts. Ms. Monison, it is such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Emily, can you provide our listeners with an overview of the scope and impact of fungal pandemics, if you will, not only on humans, but on insects, animals, and plants, because I know you humans were just one part of your book.
Yeah, that's right. So first, I just need to say that fungi are very important in our lives, and most fungi are probably beneficial, if not doing anything. So fungi themselves aren't a problem, but I write about a set of fungal pathogens, disease-causing fungi, that have caused pandemics and epidemics across species. So in forest trees, fungi have wiped out the American chestnut tree from the East Coast. Bats in the East Coast have suffered greatly from fungal pathogens, frogs around the world, and other species, including, as you mentioned, humans, although we're sort of the least susceptible of all of these species that I write about.
You know, in your research, what surprised you the most about the ways these fungal pandemics affect these different species? You just mentioned humans are least susceptible, but what surprised you the most?
Oh, that's a good question. I think just how utterly destructive they can be, and that in many of these cases that once a fungal pathogen gets entrenched in either a geographical region or, you know, within a species, it's very hard to eradicate that pathogen. Go ahead.
Well, let me ask you this. Like, what can you kind of share a case study that really kind of really illustrates the severity of how these pandemics impact wildlife for agriculture, for that matter?
Yeah, so I guess the closest to my heart is the little brown bats here in the Northeast, and these are hibernating bats. And these are bats that we used to see in our neighborhood all the time. We used to watch them fly out of our church. It was a thing to do at night. And then we watched them disappear. And it took a couple of years before we all learned that they disappeared because they had a fungal disease that causes something called white nose disease. It was a fungal pathogen. And that pathogen, which emerged, I think, sometime in the mid-2000s, has just creamed the bats in the Northeast, and it's spreading across the country. And that, like I said, you know, once it's comes entrenched in, these are hibernating bats, so they spend their winters in caves, which is where they get exposed to the fungus. And it's been a very difficult thing for scientists to figure out how to save these bats.
How do these pandemics, in this case bats, and maybe other groups, how do they influence human health or ecosystems with humans?
Well, so just like, you know, everything's part of the, we're all part of the one big ecosystem in some way. And so when we lose a member of that system, there are upstream and downstream impacts, so that the bats here, they're very important, say, for agriculture. So we've got a lot of farmers around here, and bats are important for catching insects. And I think there's some figure out there that, you know, altogether, bats save like over $1 billion in agricultural costs by consuming insects. And then there are other studies where frogs, you know, frogs in places where there's lots of mosquitoes, when those frogs are disappearing because of a fungal pathogen, there's the potential for an increase in mosquito populations and then impacts from mosquito-borne diseases.
Well, it is all interconnected. Let me get back into the human realm here. There's a description, I loved it, from one of the interviews in your book, of the creature from the Black Lagoon organism, otherwise known as Candida. Is this the fungus that humans have to worry about with regards to the disease?
Yeah, so this is, I write about a yeast called Candida auris. And so most of us are probably familiar, for better or worse, with a different fungus called yeast fungus called Candida albicans, which is just part of our microbiome, the yeast that live in us and on us, just like we have a microbiome, we have a microbiome. So Candida auris is an emergent yeast pathogen, or yeast disease-causing yeast, and it emerged fairly recently, only about in the 2016s or so, was, you know, or a little bit earlier, was when it was first detected. And this has, as described by the CDC scientist, it's a frightening fungus. And in part because when it emerged, so it became on the scene in patients that were infected. And I should step back and say that most people that are most susceptible to this are those who tend to be immunocompromised.
Sure.
Or otherwise compromised, because humans do have a lot of protections against yeast pathogens. One is our warm temperature, the other is our robust immune system. So anyway, when that came on the scene, it turned out that it emerged not only as a new novel kind of pathogen, but it was also resistant to many of the antifungals that doctors can use to treat the pathogen. So it was sort of a double problem. And it seemed to spread, or it can spread, from person to person, which is very unusual for a fungal pathogen.
One of the things that really kind of haunted me is, I think, and maybe you can describe this better, is that when I think a New York hospital had a patient there, and the patient had one of these fungal infections, that after that patient was no longer in the room still had loads of fungus in it, and they had a, if I understood you correctly in the book, knock out the walls and everything because they couldn't get rid of it?
Yeah, I believe they removed some of the ceiling tiles because it did inhabit the room. And this was at the very beginning of this outbreak. And so it was a time when they didn't really understand how that the standard hygiene procedures and the solvents that they would have used to sort of sterilize a room weren't working for this particular fungus. They now understand better how to contain and control the Candida auris, but that was in the beginning. And it was also kind of shocking that you could have something that could, you know, get on equipment and countertops and walls and be difficult to remove.
Yeah, it's thank you for clarifying that, because it left me with a sleepless night. You mentioned that humans have a couple protections, the immune system and temperature. And I'm curious, because we are all talking climate change, how has climate change impacted that temperature protection for humans? Can you explain that concept and how it works to help us?
Yeah, so this was one of the interesting things that I learned while writing the book. I spoke to a scientist, Arturo Casadevall, and he has a hypothesis that this particular fungus, Candida auris, emerged because it evolved to tolerate warmer temperatures, in part because of climate change. Most fungi do not tolerate our warm body temperatures, which I always forget exactly what it is because mine runs low.
Okay. 96.
Yeah. So fungi don't like that temperature, most of them. Very few do. And so for that reason, we really don't have a problem with a lot of fungal pathogens. And this is why other animals like frogs, amphibians, snakes are susceptible to fungal pathogens, and why the bats that we have up here, they run very warm, but in the winter they hibernate and their body temperatures drop. And so they are susceptible to that particular fungal pathogen. So we are protected by our temperature, but the thought is that as fungi that are in the environment, which tends to be their normal home for many fungi, is just somewhere out in the environment, and it's thought to be the same of Candida auris, this one that is, you know, newly emergent, is that it lives somewhere in the environment. But at some point, because of warming temperatures, it evolved to sort of tolerate a warmer and warmer temperature until it could eventually tolerate our body temperature, and now it can infect us.
One of the things you mentioned this briefly a few moments ago is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of good antifungal medications, and maybe I got that wrong, but is that true that the antifungals that we have for human disease management, we either have resistance to them or we just don't have a big option list for them?
Yeah, so it's more that there's not a big option list. So I think there are maybe three or depending on what kind of antifungals you're talking about, three or four classes of fungal antifungal compounds, unlike antibiotics, where there are many more classes or different kinds of antibiotics that they can treat you one after the other if, you know, your bacteria pathogen is resistant. That's not the case with fungi because there's only the three or so different classes that they can use. And so they still, you know, those antifungal medications still work for something like, you know, if you have Candida albicans infection, they'll work. But for some fungi that are evolving resistance, they are running out of options. And Candida auris is one where, like I said, it when it emerged, when it, you know, first started infecting people, it was already resistant to the standard antifungal medications. And so the concern is when you get an infection that can't be treated at all, which I think some physicians are now seeing, it's really kind of a frightening and discouraging and sad situation. So we need more antifungal classes, you know, different kinds of antifungal medication.
Let me ask you, so are there any, do you have examples of what you hope to see as promising or hopeful for good interventions or management practices for these fungal pathogens or fungal pandemics that are highlighted in your book? Are there, do you see some hope at least in terms of what are some promising approaches to try to avoid this, or is this more we have to sound the alarm to this?
Well, so I think so for many of the ones that I write about, we are the reason that these new pathogens are, you know, have emerged, and it's because we've moved them from one place to another. So they're living happily in their local, you know, home environment, but we've moved them and they found a new host that is completely susceptible to them. And so one thing is that, you know, there's hope that if we become more aware of moving these things around, whether it's in the animal trade or the plant trade, agriculture, that we can, you know, become more careful about moving these things around. We practice prevention so that we do better testing, you know, if better diagnostics comes about, which I think will come about. We saw this with COVID, how quickly the diagnostics for, you know, being able to test for a virus, if we can quickly test for certain fungal pathogens, then that might, you know, enable importers or exporters to you know, test and ensure that they're not passing around pathogens. So that's all hopeful. And the other thing is that in some of the pandemics, particularly in the bats and possibly in the frogs, it seems like some populations of infected animals might be able to survive or resist the pathogen. And if those populations are allowed the sort of space and time to, you know, survive, so if we don't impact them in other ways, they might evolve resistance and survive and, you know, evolve to sort of live with the fungus. So, but to do that, they also need to have, like I said, you know, the opportunity to do that, which means we're not disturbing them in other ways.
Understood. Now, I'm very curious, how did you become interested in this area? What is your background and what led you to pursue this group that's so fascinating?
So I'm a toxicologist by training. So for a long time, I've been interested in sort of how we impact the world and then the consequences for us. And I think I've always been interested in microbes because it's just, they're not chemicals, but they're, right. You know, they're fascinating. Pathogens, I think, are just fascinating. And in this particular case, I think my interest actually started years ago when a fungus-like organism, which is called Phytophthora infestans or late blight, came up the East Coast and started killing our tomatoes. And that was also, I think that was in the 90s or 2000s. It was something we never had before. You could grow tomatoes, and in August, you could pick some nice, great, sure, ripe tomatoes. And then this pathogen got spread up the East Coast. And now every summer, you just hope that, you know, your tomatoes will get to be mature and ripe before they're wiped out by this fungus-like organism. And I think that just showed me how, one, moving plants around, because it's likely that that came up with plants that were distributed from, you know, a central distributor to a lot of the places we buy our plants. So one, how we spread something around, and then two, how devastating that can be, and three, how it doesn't go away.
Let me ask you just a simple, basic question that someone asked me. How How is a fungus different from a bacteria or an animal for that matter?
That is an excellent question. So fungi have their own kingdom, which means we have, you know, there's a bacterial kingdom,
right?
There's an animal kingdom, a plant kingdom, and a fungal kingdom. So they are their own kind of organism. They do have, though, they're more closely related to animals or to us than they are to plants. So when people first started seeing fungi, because they would see mushrooms, that, you know, they thought they were more like plants
Sure.
than animals. But actually, they're more closely related to us. And we share the same basic cell type. So we are eukaryotic. Our cells are called eukaryotic cells, has to do with the formation of the cell. And it's the same. Fungi are also eukaryotes. So their basic cell type is very similar, which also means it's important for antifungal medications because bacterial cells are very different from our cells.
I see.
And so it's a little bit easier for developers to find and for us to take antibacterial chemicals because we're killing off something very different from our own cells. When we try to do the same with fungal cells, because we have the same cell type, those things that are toxic to fungal cells may also be toxic to our own cells. So it sort of narrows the options.
It almost makes it like chemotherapy in a weird way.
Yeah, there's the potential. A lot of the antifungals, at least the early ones, were pretty toxic. I think, you know, it's so.
Let me, one of the things that I teased is that the HBO is a big hit, a zombie hit, but it revolves about fungal pandemic. And I guess, let me just ask the question because I brought it up. Does anything that show has put out there, the show and the game, does it carry truth in terms of a warning for us, or it's just Hollywood?
So what it does is it got everybody aware of fungal pathogens. That was a good thing. I've been asked and I'm not a mycologist and I'm not a physician.
Understood.
I think most of those mycologists and physicians would say it would be there's a very low risk of human fungal pathogen doing to us what it didn't show, one, infecting our brains, but also just infecting humans in such large numbers like it did. So we're unlikely to see a pandemic like frogs and bats and agricultural crops are having with fungi.
Understood. Now, in this context of climate change and increasing global interconnectedness, how do you see the future fungal pandemics evolving? Or maybe better put, what can we as humans do to either prepare or prevent?
I think that's a good question. I think one of the most important things is, most consequential as we go forward, it will be the impact of fungal pathogens on crops. And I think we need to rethink how we grow our crops. So I write about the role, you know, the impact of fungal pathogens on monocrops, in this case, bananas, and just how quickly they can spread, how difficult they are to treat, how much better fungi are at being able to evolve and resist whatever chemical we throw at them. So we really need to think about how we're growing our crops, because there will be, I think most people would agree on this, is that there will be other fungal pathogens, they will impact our crops. And, you know, if you really want the apocalyptic scenario, you can imagine fungal pathogens impacting some of the major staple crops all at the same time, which would just be a totally frightening scenario. And one of those, I think some of the apocalyptic movies and shows kind of use that as, you know, the how did we get here?
Got it.
Yeah.
In our last moment, What do you hope for a listener out there to take away from reading your book? What message do you hope that they take away from it?
Ooh, maybe some respect for fungal pathogens, or just knowing that they're out there and that they're important. Also knowing that, you know, while some of these things are really big and it's hard for us to really do something, you know, about crop pathogens or whatever, You know, when you're traveling and you just see those signs that say, please don't take fruit and vegetables,
Yes.
don't do it. Just that's one way you can contribute is just don't do it. And other, you know, a recent talk someone brought up, you know, growing native plants instead of focusing on all the imports is another way. Or just, you know, if you like to plant ornamentals, ask if, you know, think about health certificates and encourage nurseries to have health certificates and test their plants so that we're not spreading these things around in the ornamental crops. Things like that. They're not big things, but you know, there's some steps we can take.
I'm going to let that be our last word. Emily, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time and helping to calm us all down, that The Last of Us isn't necessarily our future. And thanks for a terrific book.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
We've been talking to Emily Monison. She is author of a terrific new book entitled Blight, Fungi, and the Coming Pandemic. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Brady Corum is our director. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Next week's program is our season 3 premiere episode on the latest on pediatric obesity. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tweet me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.